Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
What's good, internet? It is Austin Walker. It is October 17th, 2016. I am not live in the bunker today. I am working from home, sick. Joining me, hopefully not sick, Patrick Klepek.
See, I'm in the tail end of being sick. Okay. I was sick and doing my best to mask it all last week. I have now moved to the annoying cough and congestion phase in which you feel fine, but you feel like garbage because you are just coughing all over the place and you're phlegming up at 4 a.m. because your body's coughing because it's a natural response. And I get it, body. You're doing what you need to do to get that stuff out of your lungs. But oh boy, it sure wakes a baby up at 4 a.m. when you cough all over the house.
Yeah, it's not good. I'm still in the like muscle pain part of this. I'm in the like, oh wow. Like, did you know that being could be a painful thing? Like, because it is. That's where I'm at. If you hear trucks or sirens or horns or just like the sounds, I live near where they shoot movies sometimes, or TV, I guess. And so sometimes there's just car chases here. So if any of that stuff happens,
what?
I don't know. It's.
I like how that could also just be because you live in New York.
Yeah,
but
who knows?
Specifically because you live across the street from the places where they shoot
movies,
films,
yeah,
and
that's,
TV shows.
Yeah, so so that could be that. But you know, other than that, it's nice to be recording from not in the bunker today, is what I will say. It's like, it's a trade off.
You're
like,
as comfortable as you can be.
Given the fact that my entire body is in constant pain. Yes. Yes, exactly.
That's in some ways the subtle muscle pain is worse than something excruciating.
Yes, but I'm happy to be here anyway. Like, this is the nice thing about doing a shorter podcast is I feel like I can get this one. I could not do a beast cast, let alone a bomb cast, on a day like today. But I can do whatever the name of this podcast is. I can do that.
Well, today we're doing our first 3.5-hour podcast.
No.
We've loaded ourselves up with guests. It's going to be great, Austin. You're going to muscle through it. It's going to be fine.
I will say we have a lot on the docket today when I look at the stuff to talk about. Like, normally we come in here on a Monday and it's like, I don't have anything to talk about. Like, I'm going to have to make some shit up. But today it feels like...
Austin, we do that every day of our jobs.
That is my entire life. It feels like I'm just making shit up. I don't know.
Yeah.
But today I feel like there's some stuff. And so I'm going to start with the biggest news. This is it. This is the big one. I played some Elder Scrolls Online this weekend.
Wait. Okay. So, wait.
ESO
wait.
Or TSO. T-E-S-O. TSO.
You have an enormous backlog of games. You have very little
time
to play games.
Yeah, I haven't played Doom. I haven't played
and your
Fallout
your
4
choice,
DLC
your choice,
that's supposed to be good. I still have to beat
your
The Witcher.
Your choice was Elder Scrolls Online?
I have VR. I'm touching PSVR right now. Real talk, though, I could not even imagine. Like, there was a point the other day where I was like getting tea out while I was like trying to recover from this thing, and I realized it felt like I had just finished a big VR session. Like, that's what the feeling of being sick felt like. It was like, oh, I put too much time in. I put like 4 hours into VR or something. I hadn't, but that was the feeling I had. Yeah, I played Elder Scrolls Online. I did it.
Okay, before we get to your impressions of it, which are less interesting to me than the thought process that led towards playing the Elder Scrolls Online, well, get me there.
So, Elder Scrolls Online came out in 2014. I was not a big fan of it. It didn't feel like an Elder Scrolls game to me. I think that was kind of the common response.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of reasons, like it felt, a lot of the animation felt off. The biggest symbol of this, almost like the thing that I would point to as being emblematic of it, was that like you could see a sword on the ground and not pick it up. Right? Like, it was just set dressing. Or if you beat a bad guy and they died, like, you couldn't loot them because they didn't actually have any of the gear. And that's like the thing that ties together a lot of the Bethesda games, is like, oh, there's almost like a simulation element of this where everything in the game is in the game and you can touch it and fuck with it and take it and break it down and whatever. And in general, it was also just kind of split apart into zones in a way that Elder Scrolls games aren't, and that a lot of the Bethesda open world games aren't. And so apparently earlier this year, I learned on PC, they released a thing called the One Tamriel update. They've been doing all these updates. They've been doing updates, and the DLC has been apparently really good. And it's been like they've been kind of honing their tools and figuring out how to make the game feel more like what people want as an Elder Scrolls game. It's also been super successful on console, apparently. Like, it's way more successful on console than on PC.
Those weirdos over at Iron Galaxy apparently did a good job.
I see who it is. Okay.
Version of the game.
Fucking Dave Lang every time. Yeah. Good or bad, it turns out. Good or bad. You know how in Phoenix Wright, it's like whenever something smells, it's the butts. We've got to find something for Lang. Someone out there has to figure out a phrase like that, but for Dave Lang.
The butts.
I kind of got drawn back in because there's this big update called One Tamriel in which they added level scaling into an MMO where you could just go wherever the way you could in Skyrim or Oblivion or Morrowind, and the enemies would level to you. So that, like, oh yeah, I want to go do that cool DLC stuff. I want to go do the Dark Brotherhood quest, which, like, when it first came out, you had to be a certain level or whatever to go do it. But now it's like, no, I'm level 15. Like, that's fine. I can go do that right now in the same way that you could join the Dark Brotherhood in Skyrim or in Oblivion whenever you wanted to. And then also removed all the, like, faction requirements from joining different... Like, when it first launched, there were three factions, and you could only be the races that are in each of those factions. You couldn't, like, be a high elf who goes to the Dark Elf faction. Only the three races that were in the Dark Elf faction could be in that faction. And so, like, they kind of just said, like, yeah, just play this game like it's one of our other games. And they also made a bunch of other little improvements about, like, the way combat feels, and they let you start picking up a lot of the things that are just scattered around the world. Polygon actually just ran this huge article, which is kind of part of what got me back into it. My friend Jack had been talking to me about it, and I went out to look for some more info, and Polygon, I think Charlie Hall over at Polygon, just ran a really long, like, deep dive into the development of the game. And there's this one section about how, like, at one point they just hired a bunch of people to fill all of the barrels and crates with stuff in that game, because that's part of the feeling of an Elder Scrolls game. And so I put, like, 4 hours into it over the weekend, and it's still not quite what I want from one of these, but I think I'm going to start over on the PS4 and, like, try to go in blind. I did the thing of loading up an old character, and, like, boy, do I not remember how this game plays. Which, you know, you've written about in terms of Destiny, and, like, Destiny is way easier to get back into than something with skill trees, and you go in and it's like, oh, we've refunded all of your ability points, good luck.
Yeah, at least in Destiny, I know I hold left trigger, right trigger, and yo, I'm on my way.
Right, exactly. You don't have something called, like, Aedric Spear. Like, I don't fucking know what an Aedric Spear does. Is that good? Is that better or worse than a Daedric Spear?
Is it? Did you figure it out?
It's fine. It's like a holy spear. It's fine.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right.
It heals me. I kill people with it. It heals me.
Which, that's good.
Which feels evil. Like, maybe you're holy shit. Like, normally, stuff in games where it's like, oh, when you kill something, it heals you. They give you, like, words. They kind of rhetoric it up as being like, oh, it's vampiric. It's dark. It's blood magic. But in Elder Scrolls Online, that's, like, the holiest shit there is I'm going to stab you with this spear and then get my health back. I don't know. It's world building, I guess.
Look, you do what you gotta do to get things done.
That's true.
You gotta survive, Austin.
That's true. I gotta go after those Daedric Princes. Or that's whatever. True. Whatever's happening in the Elder Scrolls. I did find a book. Here's the first thing that was good. Oh, this is it.
All right.
Here we go. This is how you get me in an Elder Scrolls game.
Okay.
I was, like, having an okay time, and I was deep in some dungeon, and I found a bookshelf, and I found a book on the bookshelf, and it was like, man, this new change in the way enchanting works has fucked up the economy.
That's what the book said?
Yeah, so the way it was a letter from this dude to his, like, local like his local politician to be like, we have to start taxing enchantment runes. Because he's like, in the old days, this is seriously what the letter said. It was like, in the old days, there were local enchanters, and that meant that the prices for enchantment in Skyrim were different than the prices of enchantment in Morrowind because it reflected the local economy. So you had to bring a sword to get your shit enchanted. And, like, no one would just bring their sword from Skyrim to Morrowind. That's far. Like, so you wouldn't, like, you're only competing locally with local other enchanters. But now, in the world of Elder Scrolls Online, the people enchant, like, gems, and then you slot the gem into your equipment because it's a video game. And that has the enchantment. And this guy, like, writes this letter to his local politician to be like, man, we have got to start taxing these gems. They are ruining my business. I have no margin anymore. I love it so much, Patrick. I love when bullshit video game things are given, like, a canonical, like, backstory.
the problems of globalization in the world of Tamriel.
Exactly.
I like conceptually the idea of playing Bethesda games, and especially the Elder Scrolls ones where there are like tons of like novels that tell stories in the world. But I don't want to read like the novels, but I love the letters.
Yes,
like,
that's exactly it.
I conceptually am glad that I open up a tome and there's like 10 pages of a story I could read, but like I'm not going to do it. I'm glad someone did it, and then maybe there's someone out there that appreciates that it exists and they'll read it. But the letters, like that stuff's my jam in terms of like the world building that I will actually engage with.
Totally. Or like a nice poster. Just like give me short form world building, please. I guess this is the problem, is that eventually this is how you wind up with like skeleton next to toilet reading a book, right? It's like that's if you contract it too small, you end up with nothing, and if you go out too big, you end up with books no one will read. You got to find that nice sweet spot right in the middle.
Yeah, it's funny because there's an article I'm working on that is about a guy that has scoured all of Fallout 4 for those sort of side stories in the world that are, you know, where it runs the, you know, the Bethesda games do run that gamut of, you know, explicit sort of like handcrafted, you know, cutscenes and events that tell a story. And then there are just those moments where, you know, they need to fill the world, so they rearrange some objects they already have, but the way they rearrange those objects is actually meaningful in a way that, in some ways, is more engaging to have your imagination kind of fill in those dots than it is to have a letter that says what went right or what went wrong in this little corner of the world.
Totally, totally. It's a real skillful thing when they can pull it off right, and it's one of those things where I wonder, like, what's next for that stuff? Like, I would love to see a game... You know, what you kind of just said was, like, they use the parts they already had, the building blocks they already had, and rearrange them in different ways. I would love to see a game of the size of that with a team that was devoted to, like, building new assets for those sorts of little side stories. Deeply inefficient, incredibly expensive. Totally understand why this isn't the case. Would love to see it. Would love to see, like, this skeleton is slightly different than all other skeletons, and it's the only one. There are thousands of skeletons in this game. This one has, like, I'm sick, Patrick. I don't have good jokes. I don't have any good bits. I don't have any good goofs. A glove. I was gonna say, this one has a glove on. I don't know why that would be cool, but maybe if there was
it's good enough, Austin. It's fine. You don't stretch yourself too thin.
I have a fever. What did you do this weekend?
I didn't have a fever. You pivoted really quickly there. You really wanted out of that segment.
I needed to go. I needed to throw. Like, sometimes we do good transitions. We did a segue last week that was so good. I'm going to pat myself on the back. We did a segue so good last week that someone thanked us for not pointing out that we did a segue.
That's when it's a real good segue, is when it just segues. But the problem is, because we're all amateurs at this, when a real good segue happens, it's like really difficult to not take notice of it and be like really proud of yourself.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's why I'm doing it after the fact. I'm going to pat myself on the back for that segue we did last week today, but not at the, I'm trying to bring professionalism into podcasting, Patrick.
Finally.
That's why I've been talking about the Elder Scrolls Online for 22 minutes or whatever.
Exactly.
So what have you been doing, though?
I finished out Gears of War 4. Nice. I finished that over the weekend. I feel like the article I wrote for the site, which is basically about the first half of the campaign, not necessarily reflective of how I feel about the second half of the campaign. You know, without getting into, you know, sort of explicit story spoilers, like, I don't think it would be a surprise to say, like, you run into some familiar things in Gears of War 4, which is fine. You know, I mean, it would be shocking that a Gears of War game wouldn't slip into some really familiar clothing, both narratively and mechanically. But the first half of the game introduces some really interesting sort of like world building elements and mechanical elements that it doesn't really do a whole lot with in the second half. And I guess the storytelling part is what really actually bummed me out, because in Gears of War 4, they introduced like some really interesting ideas about what's happening on this planet. Like the female character, who I guess it says everything that I can't remember her name. Kate. There
that
it is.
Sounds
if
right.
I went long enough.
Yeah.
It would come to me. You know, she makes some really interesting comments when the characters are going through one of these abandoned outposts in which you have to go through a hospital wing. And in the hospital wing, there are all these posters
that are
encouraging people to essentially have sex and repopulate the planet, because things were so distraught after the war with the locusts that they actually need to do like a repopulation drive to encourage people to move in that direction.
Right.
And, you know, she makes a very explicit comment about how like you know, she didn't want to do that and how she felt pressures about that in her, and, you know, because that was just sort of pervasive in society. And like, it picks up some of these ideas, and, you know, that's combined with, you know, you in the first half of the game, you like encounter, you know, like tribes that have ostracized themselves from society because they don't want to be part of like the government structure that has taken place in a sort of slightly authoritarian rule after the Locust victory, or the victory over the Locust. And it just doesn't, like, the first half of the game introduces all of this stuff, and then it just sort of drops it in favor of combat section after combat section after combat section with, like, very little storytelling happening in a way that it just kind of bummed me out, because, like, you clearly had a bunch of really interesting ideas. And not that I expect Gears of War to be like this, you know, like, I mean, my expectations are firmly in check, but it was disappointing to see them pick up the ball and then immediately drop it. And it was funny because I was tweeting about this over the weekend after I finished it, and people, there was one guy who made sort of this funny, snarky response. It was like, well, yeah, that's where the novelizations come in. And like, he's totally right. Yeah. Like, I don't know if there's actually going to be Gears of War novelizations, but like, it's not going to shock me if there was like a Gears of War like book spinoff that went, did a deep dive into like the actual societal problems, because that's the kind of thing you would have to get into in a novel, as opposed to just a describing shooter. Endless combat sections.
Well, like, the thing that's frustrating, even if you're just trying to make a really good stock standard shooter, is that like one of the things that elevates the best of those above others. It, you know, I think even going back to the first Gears, you know, looking at the best Halo games, looking at something like Binary Domain is like great characterization and good character work in general. And part of having a really well-defined world and having really interesting new stuff happening in that world is that it gives you a mirror that you can reflect your characters off of, right? Like, you can like see into your characters as they see the world. And so doing that stuff in the first half of the game, like, you know, I'm only like 2 hours or an hour and a half into Gears 4 or something like that, but I got past the point you're talking about. And like, through that, like, oh, I have a pretty good understanding of like who this core four group of people is. And I was hoping to see more of that stuff. Like, I was actually really hoping that that was a game that was going to go through these, through a bunch of different places that I had never been in a Gears game. Like, not that I don't love beautiful fucked up streets, like, you know, you know, going deep into weird cavernous
caves,
yeah, things, exactly.
Yeah, get ready for some caves, Austin.
Right, well, like, that sucks. Like, it's fine. I've just been in caves a bunch, but the opening to Gears 4 was the first time I'd been in a city that was literally building itself around me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's what I found disappointing about it. It was less so that I wasn't enjoying myself. Like, I thoroughly had a great time playing through Gears of War 4 because I think part of the fact that it's, you know, as I wrote in my article, the fact that there was so much distance between 3 and 4 relative to when we normally get a sequel allows Gears of War 4 to feel fresh, or at least I missed it enough that I'm like, the repetition feels enjoyable again, because the loop of Gears of War 4, the way, you know, like the heads explode as though they are like a gusher, like a thing of candy, is pleasurable in a way that like I don't really want to fully engage with because it'll upset myself. But it's that part's okay. And it's just, I guess, it seemed like Gears of War 4 had aspirations, or at least it's when they sat down and built out that world and then structured how they're going to introduce these characters, they had all these interesting ideas, and I just would have been nice to see them follow through. And maybe they will in sequels, but it's...
Does it feel like that's coming? Is there a sequel coming?
Well, it's already announced as a trilogy, which I think is part of the problem, right? Like when characterization is mapped out over the course of 3 games, which isn't to say that I'm looking at it entirely cynically, that they go, oh, well, we're not going to get to... But, like, you know, obviously they're going to keep certain...
It doesn't have to be cynical. It can be that, like, you know, I don't know, like, I'm someone who's done fiction and stuff, and you go, like, okay, well, what's the size of my canvas? Okay, like, we can stretch this. I can deliver this story over the course of these 3 titles. I don't want to rush through this character's entire development arc in the first game, because then I'm going to have to be it'll be completely empty on the second game. I'll have to start fresh. Like, that's just a natural part of organic storytelling if what you're doing is from the jump saying, this is what I want to do. Whereas there are other times when you're like, I'm going to tell this story and hopefully maybe I'll get a chance to tell another one. In which case you end up with a little bit more focused storytelling around a single character, you know?
Yeah, and I feel like that's a little bit of what happens here, is like the beats have been thought about too early. And again, this is no insight into their process, and I could be completely misreading it. But, you know, I get the sense that, like, okay, here's the beat that's in Gears 4, and then we're ready for the beat that's in Gears 5, right. And then here's the conclusion to that arc in Gears 6, whereas I feel like it was very possible for, like, some sense of that to better meld into Gears 4 so that I was more excited about these characters at the end of it as they were going into their next adventure, whereas now, it doesn't help that the cliffhanger they end on is just, ugh, like, it is the grossest of gross cliffhangers, and, like, you are clearly in a trilogy, and, like, I, like, the way, like, you know, the optimal storytelling for even something that is planned as a trilogy is that you get a satisfying arc in that first game, and then you're excited to see what happens next.
Right.
And I don't know. They didn't really earn that in this game. It was more just, right, I kind of wish I had waited for the Gears trilogy so I could have played these back to back to back. Just because that's the way they kind of conclude the storytelling is frustrating in that manner, where I now know I have to now wait at least 2 years before this picks up, and any momentum is blunted because that cliffhanger, the cliffhanger is not enough to keep me motivated for the next 2 years. It's more that I'm going to have to, like, you know, look at a wiki and blah, 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 blah.
Right,
but
right.
It's very fun. Like, I would say, like, if you listen to what I just said for, you know, almost 10 minutes and go, dude, why are you playing the game for this? Like, if that is your response, then you are going to have a phenomenal time with Gears 4. It's really fun. The new stuff they introduced mechanically and with the weapons is great. And then I can shut up and you'll enjoy Gears 4.
How do you think Gears 5 would be if the lead character wasn't voiced by Liam McIntyre and if Laura Bailey wasn't because there's a chance that's going to happen, it turns out. We'll see.
Yeah.
So SAG-AFTRA, a couple of months ago, maybe like a year ago, it's been a while, it came out and said that they were going to, there was a bunch of steps taken in their negotiation. SAG-AFTRA is a union, is an actors union, and they were in negotiations with a number of very big publishers in the video game space, and those negotiations had not been going super well. I think like 6 months ago, somewhere like that, they had actually decided to vote. They did a vote to whether or not to authorize a committee to declare a strike. So kind of like all the members decided, yes, you're allowed to, as part of this negotiation, call a strike without having to re-vote for it then and there. And then just yesterday, SAG-AFTRA has come forward and said that on the 21st, I believe, October 21st at 12:01 a.m., if negotiations are still unsuccessful, the union will strike. As like a quick catch up, a lot of this is about things like whether or not actors need to attend every audition that a publisher puts out, stunt work, both in terms of mocap and in terms of voice stunt work, like lots of screaming and yelling, which can threaten their vocal cords. All sorts of weird kind of very, I don't want to say like inside baseball, but like everything in the world, an industry has a lot of nuances and complexities, and there's a pretty good rundown of what their platform is on the SAG-AFTRA site. But as to...
Wasn't there a element of this about participation in royalties?
Yes, absolutely. There was like also the royalty thing, which was like... I don't want to use numbers here because I just don't have them on hand, but it was a very... It was, in my previous estimation, I recall, a very kind of humble royalty decision or a royalty goal of just like, yeah, if this game sells 1 million copies, that's when the actors start getting royalties, and they're not... There's a cap on them that was not absurd. You know, we're talking about the thousands of dollars, basically.
But I know that in the conversation, as this was sort of spilling out, and, you know, part of when you run... in the run-up to a strike is sort of a narrative battle, like in the press and amongst fans, because you want to get them on their side, because I think all parties involved would traditionally like to avoid a strike. So it's like if you can apply enough pressure in the PR game. And I know that one thing that kind of struck in the craw of developers and I think rightly or wrongly hurt the argument that the voice actors are making was this point about royalties, because generally speaking, developers do not get royalties. There are exceptions to that. And, you know, people have famously heard about how, you know, Obsidian did not get a royalty bonus for their work on Fallout New Vegas because their Metacritic rating was 1% off from the average they needed to have one of those kick in, which there are just... royalties are not necessarily like sort of an institutional part of making video games. And so there was this sense that voice actors who are a component, and depending on the game, a very important component of that experience, but they are not the programmers, the artists, the designers, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so this, I remember that being the last time this flared up, this became a huge sort of sticking point where people were upset about that, but also it was like, well, should you be upset because video game developers have not unionized and demanded this?
Also have those,
is it just a jealousy issue?
Well, I don't want to go so far as it might not be as conscious as a jealousy issue, right? Like, I think ideology works in weird ways, and I think that there is definitely, games sit at this weird border between tech culture and entertainment cultures, right? And depending on where you're at, also arts culture, right? Like, there's all of these different, and each of those spaces have different conventions and different expectations. Obviously, SAG-AFTRA leans very hard into the entertainment sector, and so it has the same ideas for what performance is worth as Hollywood does, as what, you know, other creative unions do. And so it's bringing those expectations into this world that has, at the management level, almost always been operated as tech, where no unionization, you know, lots of leeway for crunch and other sorts of high intensity, let's say, workflows. Those two things are not super compatible, and seeing this debate kind of play out has been really a great learning experience for not only for like how things could turn out, but also for how people inside of this industry at various levels see themselves and see work in general and kind of understand what is possible in terms of whether or not unionization is a thing that they could ever do. And just talk to some developers, you know, there are some developers who see this and go like, well, this sucks because we're a small dev and we would love to bring on, a great voice actor, but there's no way we would be able to pay royalties. And there are other people who are huge developers who, despite being so big, are saying that paying royalties is an impossibility. And one of you might have a case. The other of you is like talking out of the side of your mouth. And it's being able to see everything kind of organized around an issue like this is always a great learning experience. I will read the both SAG-AFTRA's comment yesterday and also the companies that were in the negotiation had a follow-up. So SAG-AFTRA says, through many months of bargaining with Interactive employees, we have not reached a fair agreement covering SAG-AFTRA performers working in video games, often the most popular video games in the world. Our members have been clear. Now is the time for employers to negotiate a modern contract that covers highly profitable industry. A strike is not to be entered lightly, but when the employers leave us with no recourse, we must stand firm with our for our members. It is imperative that we secure for them the protections, compensation, and benefits they deserve. The companies up to be caught up in the strike include Activision, who else? Electronic Arts is in there, Take-Two is in there. There's a bunch of Disney character voices, Insomniac, WB. There's some other companies that I don't know at all, like Blind Light or Core of Discovery. I suspect that a lot of the places I don't know here are studios that do voice work for a litany of other games. Places like VoiceWorks Productions, probably what they do is voice actor work and then in contract for other companies. And then in response to that, those companies released another comment back saying that the video game companies, it's really weird because it's all caps. It's like the V, the G, and the C are all capitalized because it's like right. They're a bargaining group. They're an official bargaining group. So the video game companies had already scheduled bargaining sessions this week with SAG-AFTRA union leaders to attempt to reach a mutually beneficial agreement. We expect these negotiations to remain in place and will continue to attempt to reach a fair and equitable contract despite the union leadership's most recent threatened labor action. The existing contract between video game companies and SAG-AFTRA pays all performers more than $100 an hour, plus benefits, and most performers many times that. The company's current proposals on the negotiation table include wage increases for most performers and additional avenues for compensation that could yield many of hundreds of dollars more in payments for limited integration and ratification bonuses. It goes on and on. It's worth reading both of their positions here, not because I think either of their positions is like accurate to what the outcome will be, but because like Patrick said, a lot of it is theater, right? Like even the declaration of strike, not that they won't go on strike, they will, but even that, like revealing that without first announcing it privately to the video game companies, if that's true, as the video game companies are saying it is, is like kind of a like, I'm showing my hand a little bit. I'm showing you that I'm willing to go. Like, let's finish this up this week. Let's make a move right now, or else we're going to have to deal with this strike.
Yeah, so it's, you know, I guess we're kind of, we're keeping our eyes on it, but it's right now it's a little bit, it's still kind of in the posturing phase.
Yeah.
And then, you know, shit gets real if the strike actually does go.
I mean,
down.
It'll you know, by Friday's podcast, we will know one way or the other.
Cool. Well, good thing we have a Friday podcast.
But real talk, what would you feel like if Liam McIntyre was not J.D. Phoenix in Gears 5, if Laura Bailey wasn't Kate Diaz?
My life would move on. There are very few instances in which I feel like the voice of a character is intrinsically tied to my feelings towards a character, or plus or negative, which maybe it has more to do with games not characterizing well than anything else. But, you know, like, I scratch my head, you know, Nathan Drake. You can't recast Nathan Drake.
Right.
Like, that is what it is. Like, if you were to unless it was a straight-up reboot, you know, if they were to do an Uncharted 5 for some reason, and this prevented them from using Nolan North, like, that's a problem. Like, that materially impacts that game. If they recast the characters in Gears of War 4, I would not blink. I probably wouldn't have even noticed.
What about Marcus? What about Marcus Phoenix?
Yeah, Marcus Phoenix is a problem.
Yeah, okay.
Like he is an ingrained character that you have a history with. This is
such an interesting thing, because like I feel like the things that you're saying are points against SAG-AFTRA here, right? In that, like, not against their fair labor should require like a consumer to give it the thumbs up necessarily, but like
right.
In terms of a bargaining position, the fact that you, who is a game critic, a game journalist, someone who's devoted a decade more, 15, how long have you been in this industry, Patrick?
Let's not talk about that part.
Your entire adult life has been spent playing and writing about video games. And you're like, the main character of Gears 4 could change to somebody else. That's okay. I'll live. Now, which isn't a diss on the person's behavior or performance, even.
No, it was fine.
Like, in fact, it can be even a diss on, like, or not even a diss, but, like, we were talking about world building and characterization. That, like, in fact, it would have been great if that voice actor had more of a chance to develop the character with their talents. But, like, yeah, that's a tough position to be in if you're a voice actor, if even you're the people who enjoy your work aren't necessarily like moved by it enough to be like, no, you can't change them.
And it makes you wonder, you know, it's unclear to me. It makes sense for them, you know, voice actors in the bad position to make that argument that their role is of the utmost importance. But I think their argument is somewhat undercut just by the very nature of games as a medium and what their strength is, or at least what their strength is right now, sort of, you know, generally speaking, is, you know, stories support mechanics and not the other way around. And that's not every game, but that's a lot of games. And I think that it just makes it difficult on their part to make the same argument that screenwriters and actors can make with movies and television shows, which is that those just don't exist without that. And for games, that's just, it's not the case. Like, you could delete the story from Gears of War 4 and like it would still be like a pretty fun game. Like, the mechanics are really good in that game.
Right,
like, it's
right.
fun to run around and shoot
lots
things.
Of people would still play those games. I will say though that like maybe the line of argument that I would take here is that, you know, you never know when you're going to have a John Marston or a Lee from The Walking Dead where, like, oh, wow, like, there is a lot of characterization developed through this voice. And so you want rules in place for when you're going to have that breakout success so that that person is protected and so that the rest of everybody else are encouraged to continue participating in this industry instead of going to do ads, instead of going to do voiceover work for DreamWorks or, like...
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
There is a real chance that if you're doing voice acting work right now in the world of games, like, you're hoping that you're going to get the weird new small game that happens to have a really great voice acting role. But like, I could, if I was a voice actor, I don't know why I would stay in games as is. When you look at what SAG-AFTRA's, what, like, their relationships are like throughout the rest of Hollywood, the rest of the entertainment industry is a better place. I would go do anime, obviously. Like, that's just where I'd be. Like, that's just where my, you know, that's just where my heart would take me anyway. But I would, you know, I would like to see there be protections in place for the medical stuff. And you know me, I'm the dude who would like to see the artists on games get a kickback when that game sells, a, you know, 20 million copies.
Austin, we have breaking news. We have breaking news. From Software has issued a patch for Dark Souls 3.
Oh,
I want to read the first value. I want to read the first patch note on this. Adjusted poise values across the board. Poise is now more effective for heavier weapons and armor.
No way. They made
I have been fucking following this story for the better part of 12 months, in which From Software and Hidetaki Miyazaki, the chief designer of the Dark Souls series, has just, like, to my face, in the sense that we emailed questions and corresponded to translators, said that the poison mechanic was working as it was supposed to be, and now they have gone and changed it to exactly how poison is supposed to work 6 months, 8 months after that game came out. God damn it. I mean, that's good, because
the DLC's
didn't
coming
do anything.
Out. So, like, maybe now you can go back and make your, like, high poise build.
No, I mean, I don't even play characters like that. It just drove me nuts. To explain to people what the heck is going on here.
What are you talking about?
Patrick,
look at me. I know what I'm. I know what you're talking about.
Audience surrogate. Yes, audience surrogate.
That's me.
So in Dark Souls, like a lot of RPG, you know, games where you build a character, you have different points that you can drop into different attributes, and one of those that has been consistent across the Souls series is one called poise. I think I might have been called different things in some of the earlier games, but either way, it's the stat that you dump into so that your character does not get staggered when it attacks. So what I mean by that is, in a lot of action games, when you are attacking an enemy, you know, you can just keep spamming R1 or R2 or whatever and just keep attacking that enemy, even if they hit you back. Like, you guys can just kind of exchange blows all the live long day.
Right.
In Dark Souls, enemies are capable of interrupting your attack. So you can be in the middle of hitting them, and an enemy can hit you back, and it staggers you. Like, it takes you out of the attack phase. It creates an opening for them. It's, you know, if you've seen any hilarious videos where someone gets hit like 3 times in a row and then immediately dies out of nowhere, it's usually because they've been staggered.
Right.
Now, for some characters, like myself, I tend to play dodging characters, so I'm trying to avoid getting hit entirely. Other people play characters in which they dump a lot of points into poise and also wearing heavy armor, so that you can walk into the middle of a fight and get hit from every angle, and your character is not going to budge, and you can just wail away. Now, in Dark Souls 3, the poise stat didn't do anything. Like, literally, you could be dumping in dozens of points into this, and the stat says... Like, the description of the stat is that, I don't have it verbatim, but, you know, it's essentially what the stat has done in the past, that you'll be able to withstand attacks and not get staggered. And one way of making poise even, you know, more formidable is by wearing heavy armor. And people were able to demonstrate that poise literally didn't do anything. And in the game's code, there was a way of flipping a value that turned poise on. So it seemed that From Software at some point had decided to just turn poise off in the game code. But they would tell the community and they would tell the press, mostly me, because I'm the one that refused to give up, like, this story because it really bothered me.
I can tell.
As
you're
a Souls
fired
fan.
Up, Patrick.
Well, it bothered me because it appeared that they were lying. And it bothered me because they weren't being straight. And this wasn't a case where the Souls series, where the being obtuse and vague is part of the charm. This was something where it seemed like they had made a mistake. And then instead of just acknowledging the mistake or admitting, look, we just didn't want poise to work this way in Dark Souls 3, they would just kind of hand wave it away. And now this proves... or at least they're showing contrition to sort of like the general hardcore community that this is how poise was supposed to work, and now it works that way in the new patch. I will hopefully have access to that DLC today or tomorrow, so that we can talk about it on Friday. But I guess that's not really breaking news. That's like breaking news for like 0.02% of the world, but it was very important to me.
Vice Gaming is a place for people, passions, and politics. Like, this is. This is passion. This is what I want to see. This is it. So
I'm sure people were like, "Oh, I'm sure Red Dead Redemption 2 was announced." Like, no, there's a poise stat change in the Dark Souls 3 patch notes.
Listen, we all have our thing. Your thing apparently is, like, the thing that makes this great to me is you don't even fucking play this character. This isn't even the build you play. It doesn't even matter in your actual...
I don't like being lied to.
It's the principle of the thing. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. what it is. I get it.
You know, if there's anything that sums up probably the direction we want to take Vice Gaming, it is that exact. Like,
yes.
We could have been, and I am also excited for Red Dead Redemption 2, but the fact that I would spend almost 10 minutes just ranting about a poise stat in Dark Souls 3 is, I feel like that probably, if you ever wanted to know the kind of page that Austin and I are uh-huh. on, that is the page.
God. So, speaking of, though, Red Dead Redemption 2 might be a thing.
Yeah.
Probably isn't. I mean, we've been pretty sure for a minute that it's a thing.
I can give you definitively it is a thing.
Everybody sit down. Patrick's about to talk on some shit right now.
No, there's more that I know, but I don't feel comfortable sharing certain... This game exists. I don't have any inside information on how they're rolling out this announcement. It's not even a hint anymore. They put out additional artwork this morning that shows a gang of characters.
Seven cowboy silhouettes on that red background from the old.
Yeah,
Red
the
stuff.
Speculation being that's going to be Marston's gang. This will be a prequel set ahead of the last game because Red Dead Redemption, essentially, you know, the narrative arc was about the end of the West. So it would, you know, in the beginning of industrialization. So it'd be odd for them to do a sequel. It would just be tough for the Western setting.
God, I don't
want
to. I'm fine with a game that takes place earlier in the history of the West. I don't want a Marston prequel though.
Yeah, I'm going to be, you know, what? Okay, disappointed is a relative term because I'm tremendously excited for this game. I think, you know, Red Dead Redemption and Bully are probably the best games that Rockstar has put out. But another Marston game will be disappointing because I believe it. If you were to play this, let's assume this game is Marston led, and you know, let's say 3 years from now, if you play those two games together, maybe it does paint like a pretty amazing narrative arc. But for me, as someone that already played Red Dead Redemption, I had my, you know, spoiler alert if you haven't played Red Dead Redemption, but like the dude dies at the end in like one of the most spectacular, dramatic fashions that is such an amazing way for. Especially, we were just talking about how AAA games are normally so bad at this stuff.
Yeah.
And now that Red Dead Redemption doesn't have a lot of problems that it doesn't engage with about, like, the West and paint a much prettier picture of that world than maybe it should. But, like, the character of Marston, if we just focus in on that specifically, is, like, masterfully done for a game that takes place over 40, 45 hours. And, you know, I'm someone that thinks they should have just deleted Mexico from the game.
Yep.
Like, that's just like 15 hours that I could have taken in my life back. But the end of Marston's arc is like,
that game
still gives me chills.
One of the best endings in big budget video games I think I've ever played.
Absolutely.
So this is the person I am. It's like, I was like, I'll never play a game with Marston. Like, I'm never. And then like immediately started thinking, okay, well, how would I do that well? Like, what would I do if I was given the keys to the kingdom? Like, all right, make a game about these seven characters or whatever. It's Marston's old gang. What if you started playing Marston when he was the age that Jack is at the end of Red Dead? And it's that it's
oh, so they kind of have their cake and eat it too. It's like it's Marston, but like
young, shitty, like completely self-doubt, like just bad cowboy Marston, like not a good dude and like not capable yet. And then does the time jump stuff, but throughout his own life.
Yo, that sounds like a great way to narratively embed a skill tree.
It sure does. Oh, man, it's 2016 and skill trees are real.
I'm excited. I think, like, a lot of people are excited to go back to that world.
Yeah.
And also, this just goes to show with Rockstar, the fact that they take so frustratingly long... And I mean frustrating as a positive. I mean that as a compliment.
Right.
In between the sequels to their games, it's so easy to imagine Red Dead Redemption 2 having come out like so long ago. Like, how long has it been since Red Dead Redemption?
It's been
like,
forever.
Has it been 10 years?
It's been forever, man.
Google it up. Red Dead Redemption.
Yeah. I want to say
2010.
I want to say
so, okay, not ten years. But you know what? It feels like 10 years.
Well,
someone
pointed out
that's the feeling you want to go for is the feeling that it has been forever ago since a game.
Someone pointed out recently on Twitter, I think today, that it has been 5 years since they announced a new game. Like, so obviously GTA 5 was that game, but that announcement came 5 years ago.
Yeah, and you know, they've essentially been able to coast financially on GTA Online. Like, they made a big bet on the multiplayer, and my guess is that we would have already seen and they would have released a game if GTA Online had not been a success, or if it wasn't there at all. I am fairly confident in relying on my gut reaction that that has been instrumental in them being able to take their time on this next one.
I wonder if we'll see any takes around that once this game eventually comes out, or just in general, if like games as service allow not just doesn't just allow a developer to eke out more income from one game, but it lets them have more like spin up time on their next project or whatever, you know?
Yeah, and I'm already disappointed about the delay for Red Dead Redemption 2, because come on.
What do you think, 2019? 2020?
Oh, I don't know. I wonder, you know, the optimist in me wants to think they're going to pull a Bethesda.
Yeah, me too.
And that this game, Rockstar has traditionally released games mostly because they keep delaying them in the spring period, specifically May or June 2017. So my... again, this is no insight. You know, the fact that the game exists, I'll tell you, is insight. Anything else here is all just, you know, speculation on my part. I'm not going to be surprised if this game is set for May 2017 on PC, Xbox One, and PlayStation 4. And please put out a PC version of Red Dead Redemption,
please. What if the end of the Red Dead 2 reveal or 3 reveal is like, and also right now on Steam, Red Dead Redemption. Go get it.
I there are a few games I would play again that are that long because I just can't.
Yeah, but it's on PC. You can just cheat engine your way through the middle.
Yeah, I could literally just skip Mexico. And then also just that I have the modding community for that game would be fantastic. And also, this is a great chance for me to criminally overlooked in the pantheon of Rockstar releases, Undead Nightmare.
Yeah.
The expansion they put out for Red Dead Redemption might be the best written horror game, period. It's just to see Rockstar take their attempt at horror and satire, sort of a B-movie thing. It's so well done. Like, you know, it's not scary or anything like that. It's, you know, so when I say horror, I mean that in a much more general sense, but like, it's so good. I really hope they do another one of those. But if they don't, people should absolutely go back and check that out, because it was phenomenal, and I'm sure it still holds up. But even if it doesn't, it does in my head, so that's fine with me.
Yeah, you know, my question going forward is coming off of the notion of like, one, I would love to see more of the Undead Nightmare style DLC. For every game, for every big weird open world game, I love whenever they're like, yeah, this is
a left turn,
non-canonical, like, don't even worry about it, but we have this world, let's twist it up in a weird way. And then the second thing I'm really curious about is, maybe this is me zeroing in on that kind of the silhouettes of these seven people, is how important is multiplayer going to be in Red Dead 2?
Huge.
It's going to be huge.
There's
right?
no
like,
way
it's
not integral.
The success
integral.
Of GTA Online, and frankly, the success of Red Dead Online, which was at the time, like I played Red Dead Online with so many people, and it was just one of those things that felt like it was on the precipice of breaking. Like, it was just like, oh wow, it's just really fun to be with my buds in this huge weird world, and we're going hunting and we're exploring and we're getting into gunfights with other groups. And I could see them maybe trying to integrate that stuff a little more cleanly, especially after like they nailed what heists are like, what multiplayer heists are like in GTA 5 Online. I would do some Wild West heists with my buds. That sounds all right.
I mean, what you have to be excited about is Rockstar's sort of like base mechanics have come so far since Red Dead Redemption. You know, the gunplay in GTA 5 is just, you know, just bounds better than the stuff that we were putting up with in their previous games, where we were sort of blinded by the open world part of it and put up with sort of the shoddy sort of like base running around and shooting mechanics. So like, the fact that we're going to get a next gen Red Dead with like that level of competency on a mechanical level is plus also the idea that they've spent the last like 3 years working on the online stuff. Like, that stuff will probably be much more cleanly integrated this time in a way that may make it that more people like you and I that tell ourselves, wow, I really wish I would have gone in and played that. If it's there since day one and it's really cleanly in there, it could be really exciting how they pull that off.
You know, the other thing there that I guess I'm maybe a little excited about is, and I think it was Brendan Keough who talked about this before, is I could see a Red Dead sequel being different tonally than GTA 5 was. That, like, there was this almost like an arc from GTA 4 to Red Dead Redemption to, you know, a little bit of it in LA Noir, which I know was a not a Rockstar North joint, but right. Still had that Rockstar touch, where, like, oh, this is a game that, you know, obviously their satirization is happening here, but it is willing to go beyond, like, just comedy isn't its foundation, right? So it doesn't have that excuse for poor characterization, and so the writing in each of those games, I think, was a lot stronger than GTA 5's. I don't hate GTA 5. I had a decent enough time with it. I think it has some problems. I've spoken about those problems before. But I think that the general tone and tenor of Red Dead, like Bully, like GTA, like parts of GTA 4, especially the early and mid parts of GTA 4, like, show that Rockstar, when they're not devoted to just satirizing America, can do this other thing. They can work in this other mode, and I'd like to see them do that, especially for me coming off of Mafia 3. I'm still playing through Mafia 3. I'm getting towards what I think is the end. But, like, oh, wow, it was really cool to play a game like this where every five things on the radio aren't just, like, a South Park joke. And, I, you know, yes. There's a place for that in the world, for sure, but I like also having this other sort of stuff. And when I say there's a place for that stuff in the world, I don't mean, like, I don't even necessarily mean in my life, right? Like, I don't think I'll ever go back and play Saints Row 2, which I think was, like, a bad version of, the worst possible version of, like, you know, shitty scatological humor. Like, it wasn't even well delivered. But I get that some people want that stuff. Whereas I just want there to be more attention paid to these types of games where you're using the big open world to communicate something. And that thing can be comedy and can be, you know, horror and can be all this other stuff. But the core of it is, wow, look at these interesting characters. Look at these relationships. The relationship between John Marston and Bonnie is, like, really fucking good in Red Dead. The relationship between, mm-hmm. between John and his family is really good. Like, that's the mode I'd like to see Rockstar get back to. Again, like, not for everything they ever do. I hate that I'm qualifying this as if to, like, put up a shield from criticism. Like, I just, but that is the mode I want to see them in again.
Yeah. So, presumably, I'd be shocked if we're going to go a full week without that reveal. So, hopefully, we'll have more to say about that when we see something proper on it in the next couple of days. But I'm excited.
Me too.
And, you know, there's no other company that can get 100,000 retweets by posting an image to Twitter.
And, like, an image of their logo.
Maybe Bethesda?
An image of their logo.
Yeah, like, today was only when we got artwork from presumably the game. But I also, you know, if I think in my head, you know, what other game out there is there this much pent up demand for a sequel that has been, like, so, like, maybe Beyond Good and Evil, but Beyond Good and Evil, that's a tiny slice of video gamedom. Like, Red Dead is that rare cross section of everyone. Unless you are Jeff Gerstmann, loved Red Dead Redemption.
Well, it was across. It was across, like, all weird categories of people who play games. Like, if you were like me, a weird games academic, you found something to love in Red Dead. If you were someone who just wanted to get online with your friends and shoot some shit, there was a lot to love in Red Dead. If you were just, like, the person who goes into a Walmart or a Best Buy and says, like, oh, what's, like, a cool new game? Oh, cool, the people who made GTA made a cowboy game. Great, like, that game is going to be great for you. Like, a ton of people loved Red Dead for a billion different reasons. So it's a big act to follow. We'll see.
Also, yeah, I'm excited to see them follow.
Someone should make Jeff play through Red Dead again.
That's, you know what? That's good premium series for Giant Bomb. Just forcing Jeff Gerstmann to play through the entirety of Red Dead Redemption. Come on.
Red Dead Redemption. Yeah, that's I'll workshop it.
We'll get there. Well, we're hitting towards the hour. We should probably find our way towards this question bucket.
We should. Let's reach on into the question bucket. Yeehaw. That's not. Give me a number.
Oh, no.
That's not. Oh, I can do a southern accent. That isn't it. That's not the one.
Let's see. Let's see. It's the 17th Red Dead Redemption. That teaser thing go out on Saturday. So that would have been The 15th? Let's go with 15.
All right, sure. Hey, man, this is a really good one. This is from Naveen in Toronto, who says, can you help me understand why major video games almost never hit their initially stated release date? I get a couple slipping here and there, but at this point, I find myself adding a year onto the proposed release date of any big-budget video game. Video games are an established industry with companies worth multiple billions of dollars each, and it boggles the mind that they can't hit self-imposed deadlines. Other industries that work on multi-million dollar projects, such as enterprise software or construction, typically make their deadlines, so that can't be a scale thing. I get that video games are a more creative industry, but then how does the movie industry keep its release dates when it's just as creatively focused?
I feel like the reasons for that are different for every project. But I mean, I think generally speaking, it's it's that the video games are more fluid than the process of making almost anything else. Maybe books are comparable, I suppose.
Yeah, but books can be comparable.
But there are just so many moving parts in a way that video games have not, and maybe never will. Maybe it's just a function of how games are built, or maybe this will be something in, you know, 20 years we look back and go, oh, right, like games are now, you know, especially on the large scale, are more like films where you just kind of plug in. In some ways, that is true, right? Like, look at Call of Duty, right? Like, there are games that function in a capacity that is very similar to what he's talking about Hollywood, where tentpole releases are, you know, they pluck out a date, or even if they're not announced until, you know, Call of Duty games aren't really announced until about 6 months out. But, you know, those internally, you know, those games are on a 3-year cycle. They know their date. They're structuring their production in a way to hit that date over the next 3 years. But I think it's just a lot of games are messy, and that messiness is not necessarily apparent until the very end. Like, I think what's different about video games is so much about what makes that video game work or not work is not apparent until you have to get to that pivot where you're getting ready to ship. It's within, when you get to that last, you know, and this depends on the scale of the game, but let's take a AAA game. That stuff starts to come together, let's say, in, you know, the last like 9 months as you head towards release, as systems start clicking into place, and what's in your head and what your vertical slice is suddenly starts percolating through the whole game. And it may be at that point you realize, oh no, this doesn't work. And
yeah, that's what you hear from people in the development industry like constantly is, we put 3 or 4 years into a game and don't know if it's good until 6-7 months out before a release.
Right.
Like, because every game is bad until that point. Like, every game goes through this arc where, like, you have your design document, you have great art assets, you can maybe get a character, it feels okay to move around, but the things don't click together and where it's actually a good time to play until very late into development, which means that you can hit a point where it's like, oh shit, like, we made a bad one. This needs to go back. Like, we need to polish this, and this in order to make this something we're comfortable shipping. Like, you can't necessarily forecast your success very cleanly. And I think the other thing here, too, is, like, most movies don't have to invent the camera every time that they're going out into production, right? Like, most directors don't start by going, all right, well, we already used this HD camera last time, but, like, that other movie looks dope. Let's get that camera this time. Like, that does happen, obviously, in some very, very big blockbuster things, and that obviously can happen in CG and stuff like that. But for the majority of films, it's like, oh, yeah, we're going to use this camera. This camera works. And this camera frames shots the way cameras frame shots. Obviously, there are nuances. I'm not, like, going to tell you that camera A is equal to camera B. But, like, the fundamentals of filmmaking are developed and separate from the tools, whereas we're constantly seeing the development of new tools shape the development of new gameplay mechanics, shape new, you know, methods of showing aesthetics. You know, when Harvey Smith was in here just a couple of weeks ago, he was talking about how they developed a new kind of rendering engine for the way that Dishonored 2 would look. And, like, that's just a step that you don't need to take in these other industries. You know, when you make a piece of enterprise software, you don't start by going, like, what if instead of Windows, it was something else? You know, like, that's not
Linux. Let's just build it for Linux.
Right, exactly. Like, everything we do, and a different distro of Linux, too. Like, that's just not, so there's like, that common foundation for those other things that allow you to kind of jump to the creative process and better estimate how much time it's going to take for you to make the thing you're trying to make. It's tough. I've said it a bunch. Video games are difficult. Video games are tough, man.
And often, you know, release dates are announced with the best of intentions.
Yes.
That a release date is a way of crystallizing a game, right? So, you know, in the same way that deadlines, you know, I speak from a writer's perspective, sometimes it is useful to be told, hey, you have 90 minutes to finish this. Mm-hmm. It has to just be up, because you end up very quickly figuring out, what do I need to do to make this happen? Now, is there a world where maybe that article or this game is better because you get another, let's say, 6 hours to write it or 6 months to polish it? Maybe, but often the fact that you have a deadline may be the only reason it gets finished and into a shape that is presentable at all. And I think that's, you know, that is definitely the case with some video games. You know, the famously Rod Ferguson, who was the head of the Coalition, who was seen as the closer
right.
on the Gears games, and he also went into BioShock Infinite, mm-hmm. And was brought in as someone that can look at a project and go, oh God, like this is not going to ship for ever possibly in its current place, and come in and find a way to get that out. Release dates function in that way. And so often if, you know, they may set a release date that, yes, it ships a year after that, but the only reason it's going to ship that year later is because they set that original release date in the first place, because by the time the game gets close to that original release date, they may now have crystallized, okay, we know what this game is. We know how to get it in the direction we need to. Now this last year or 6 months or whatever the delay ends up being, that's the point where they can focus in and get it to be the game they want it to be, because they couldn't have gotten it there without being forced to the original date in the first place.
Oh, and the other thing that happens here too sometimes is you get that extra money, you get that extra cash influx that lets you say, like, oh, we can actually extend development and just make this better. Like, yeah, we could ship, you know, at day X, but it turns out GTA Online has done really well for us. Or it turns out that this other side contract project that we did has extended our development, you know, life. And so, like, those things for me, there's definitely times when I've been bummed that something's gotten delayed. I remember being a little kid and Time Crisis for the PS1 got delayed. I called my EB Games, or I think it was an EBX at that mall, every day for 6 months because it was delayed indefinitely. And it did come out eventually, but they didn't like give a date. It wasn't like no one knew when it was coming. So I just called every day. So I've been there. I've been the person who has been, I was like 13, so it's a different situation now than it was then. But like, I've been there where I've been excited for something to come out and been bummed when it gets delayed. But someone who likes good games, I'd almost always rather at least the first or second delay. By the time you get to the third or fourth delay, you start going like, uh-oh, like, what's up with that project? What's going on? Like, is everything okay? Is there a problem with the tech? Is there a problem with management? Is there a problem with, like, some key wing of the development studio? Like, what's going on? But in general, like, the first couple of times something gets pushed back, I just generally say, all right, well, we're going to get a better game out of this in another year or another 6 months. Like, let's just wait. My backlog is already huge. You know, like, I'm already, like I said, The Witcher, Gears 4, Doom, Elder Scrolls Online. There's so much to play out there.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly, I felt this when Uncharted 4 kept getting these, like, six-week delays right. over and over again. Like, those are the ones where you can kind of raise your eyebrow at, because, and also it gives me a queasy feeling on my stomach because I know for a fact, you know, that's, you know, those are developers that are then crunching for another 6 weeks. You know, it's not like they're getting 6 weeks so that people can take proper vacations and things
right.
like that. That's
right.
just a game under the grind so it can, you know, ship at the bare minimum it needs to get out the door. But yeah, I mean, I think it's part of life. I think you are totally right to have the perspective that just add a year, because I feel like, you know, I want to live in this world where Rockstar's waited to get this game mostly done and they'll announce it, promote it for the next 9 months and it'll come out next May. Am I going to be shocked if it gets delayed to September and then somehow gets delayed again to the spring of 2018? Like, no, but, you know, I think you're right to be cautious. Like, just like you don't pre-order games, also don't expect the games are going to ship when they say they do.
Exactly. Well, I think that's going to bring it to a close this Monday. It is going to be a long week this week. I'm already sick.
Yeah.
Got a lot going on. I don't want to commit to anything, but there's a lot going on this week. You can find me on Twitter at Austin_Walker, on Facebook at Austin Walker Games. Patrick, where can people find you
that
on the internet?
You're going to have to say that every single
episode. I got to say it. They told me. Mr. Vice brought me into the office. He was like, Shane Smith brought me into the office. He's like, you know what, Austin, people really are on Facebook a lot these days. That's where they are.
Have you seen it? Have you been looking? This Facebook thing's big.
Yeah. God.
It actually has been weird because since we mentioned it, people have started liking it.
I know.
And I'm like, all right, I have that page and people are liking it. So thanks for doing that, folks.
I should put some content on there. There it is.
You should link your Twitter feed. We almost
Austin
made it to the end of the episode.
Walker on Twitter.
Yeah. I'm saying you can link that to your Facebook page.
Oh, is that what I can do?
Yeah, so then your Twitter content just becomes your Facebook content.
Do I retweet it too? Because if I'm not getting my good knife bot retweets, then what's the point?
I don't think so. I think it's only your content. Other people's content that you retweeted content is not content.
Everyone should follow at Live Cut Corner, which is a bot that takes images and video clips from the knife show, Cutlery Corner, where they sell knives. It's
okay.
It's funny. It's funny.
Okay, I believe
you. I'm sick. I have a fever.
I know. We got to get out of here. I'm at Patrick Klupik. You can follow me at P. Klupik on Facebook. At some point, if we say this enough times, then we'll just get over it, and it'll be the shame will just be ingrained into our sign-off. But, yeah, and then you can follow all of our work at vice.com/gaming. And then what's questions at Vice Gaming? No, wait. No, gaming@vice.com. Title questions, and you can become part of the question bucket.
Thank you so much. Thanks also to Tim Barnes, our podcast producer. Thanks to Bo N for letting us use the track Miss You off of his EP, Pale Machine. I'm just going to give you the Bandcamp today. That's what I'm going to do. Bo N, Bandcamp, put that in Twitter. It's probably what you can do. BoN.bandcamp.com will take you right to where you can go buy Pale Machine, including the track Miss You. You can find Vice Gaming stuff at vice.com/gaming and at twitter.com/vicegaming. Also on Facebook, Vice Gaming on Facebook. Continue to shoot us some reviews over on iTunes and Google Play and all those other stores. That means a lot. We are currently new and noteworthy, I believe, on iTunes, which that's cool. I'm pretty happy about that. So more reviews, more thumbs up, share it, do all that stuff. Patrick,
likes.
This is, I don't know how to, it's because I'm sick again. I got really good at this for like the last 3 weeks, and now I'm back to being.
I know. You're overthinking it.
Let me just say it like this. Peace.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.